Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the World Health Organization provides guidance to countries facing health crises. How effective is this arrangement? And what is the relationship between countries and the World Health Organization? How does it promote cooperation on global issues like this pandemic? What lessons are we learning? Contributing host Doug Becker explores.
Thank you very much for joining us on scholarcircle.org this week. A quick note, we're recording via online conferencing, video conferencing, so the sound quality is not to the same level as when we record in studio. We're practicing social distancing. We're sure you'll understand. On March the 11th, the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a global pandemic. This triggered a set of regulations and made resources available to nations to combat the virus. On today's show, we examine what the World Health Organization is, what the declaration of the global pandemic means, and how effective the global response to this virus has been. Our guest is Heather Whipfley, Associate Professor of Clinical Preventive Medicine and International Relations at the University of Southern California. She has written The Global War on Tobacco, which examines how the World Health Organization negotiates and binds regulations on countries. Thank you for joining us, Professor Whipfley. And my first question to you is, we've heard quite a bit about what the World Health Organization has declared COVID-19 a pandemic. Let's start with, what exactly is the World Health Organization attempting to accomplish as its piece of global governance?
It's so great to be here. So the World Health Organization is an organization that is affiliated with the United Nations that has the responsibility of coordinating health response and health care within the United Nations system. So it's a member state organization. That means that individual countries belong to it, not individuals or companies or different non-governmental organizations, just states. And they all have a vote, and they help to decide what the priorities for that organization are and the different types of rules that they were going to follow in regards to our health response globally, whether it be in pandemic situations like we currently have now, an infectious disease, or related to other non-communicable diseases, and generally how we address health on the international stage.
And is every country in the world a member of the WHO?
Pretty much every country in the world is a member. You don't automatically become a member of the World Health Organization. If you're a member of the United Nations, you have to ratify the Constitution, but it has over 190 member states currently, and so it has a large mandate covering the vast majority, over 99% of the world's population.
And how old is the WHO? Is this a relatively recent organization, or has it been with us for a while?
WHO was established along with the United Nations system just after the Second World War. So it has been here for many, many decades, and its influence and importance in our international system has kind of ebbed and waned throughout time. It's perhaps best known as having led the campaign to eradicate smallpox in the 1960s and early 1970s, and that was really perhaps its glowing success that gave it really widespread global recognition. However, over the past few decades, it has not had such a strong leadership role. It did not take a strong leadership position during the HIV/AIDS epidemic during the 1990s. And so many other organizations have kind of arose in its place and now have competed with it for leadership within the global health space. So, of course, we have organizations like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation now, UNAIDS, and many other organizations that play a very significant role within global health besides WHO. One thing that's really unique about WHO, however, is that it does regulate and manage our global pandemic response. In other words, the kind of rules and governance systems that decide how countries should and could act during a pandemic like we have now.
You said should and could. What word you didn't use is must. Is the World Health Organization, in essence, a body that makes recommendations, or can its designations carry with it any sort of compulsory actions on the part of countries around the world?
So by and large, WHO is a technical assistance organization. Therefore, most of its resolutions and agreements are non-binding on its member states. And generally, it's been seen as an organization that provides guidelines and assistance to countries, particularly low and middle income countries, about how to respond to various health concerns within their countries. There is an exception. There's two legally binding treaties that the World Health Organization implements. One is, as you mentioned, the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, which is irrelevant in this case, but the other is the International Health Regulations, which govern specifically how countries react in a pandemic. And in that case, it is a binding international law, and countries are technically mandated to follow the rules outlined within the agreement. However, WHO also lacks really enforcement weight. It doesn't have ways to force countries to follow the agreements that have been put in place. So while it has a legal authority on paper, the ability to actually get countries to follow along with its decisions is not always so effective.
Does it have funding available? It can withhold funding or can withhold resources from countries if they don't follow the regulations?
Not particularly. WHO is not really a health delivery organization. It's very much more a normative policy-making organization in which, you know, it puts in place best practices and guidelines and rules that countries should follow. It doesn't have a huge funding base. Its budget is small in comparison to, for example, the United States Health Services budget, or even the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation or some large non-governmental foundations. So it doesn't really have the ability to widespread kind of fund health initiatives or support countries holistically in a response. They can provide assistance, especially again to low-income countries that desperately need it, but it is not particularly well-funded. That has been a challenge over the past couple decades as the member states of the organization have decided not to raise their commitments to the organization, have not increased their dues, for example, and have increasingly donated to the organization earmarked donations, saying specifically, for example, we want this money to go towards polio eradication, or we want this money to go towards road traffic injuries. And it doesn't provide just a bulk-based funding to the organization, which it could use, for example, at the moment in a case of an emergency. And in cases like now, they're really reliant on emergency sources to come in and boost their response as opposed to any kind of reserves that they may have.
Now, you mentioned something called the International Health Regulations. These are relatively new from my understanding that they've been in place for, what, about 15 years? What exactly are the International Health Regulations and what motivated the World Health Organization to adopt them?
So they're both new and very old. In fact, the basis of these regulations are the foundation of all health governance and the World Health Organization dating back to the 1800s, when we first had kind of the globalization of pandemic disease and the importation of diseases like cholera and typhoid and smallpox from colonies into the colonizers. So for example, we had sudden outbreaks of cholera in London or in New York City. And there was an understanding that we needed to develop a system of governance to help countries identify when there may be outbreaks happening in countries and so that they could put in place procedures to stop the importation of those diseases. So that was codified into the International Sanitary Regulations, initially, that's what they were called. And this was really based on this idea that there were a few specific diseases that would cause havoc around the world. And those two diseases were typhoid, smallpox, yellow fever, and cholera. And so if any of those diseases were to appear in a country, they were to notify the international community, and then countries would take actions to respond, like, for example, quarantines at points of entry. And you can easily imagine what this would look like in the 1800s. Perhaps that was quarantine boats in the harbors, or that was the quarantining of specific trains that were coming into the country from that would contain potential infected individuals or produce. And so this was the actually the entire structure of governance response until 2005. And what happened was that in 2003, we had the SARS epidemic. And at that time, we still had that same structure where countries only really needed to declare if they had an outbreak of one of those four diseases, cholera, typhoid, yellow fever, and smallpox. Of course, by 2003, those were not necessarily the pressing diseases of our time. We have vaccinations for those diseases. We've eradicated smallpox. And yet our legal mechanisms had not been updated. So in 2003, when the SARS outbreak occurred, our regulations did not cover the SARS outbreak. And we found ourselves really without a strong regulatory response because of that. So the countries decided through the World Health Organization to renegotiate the international health regulations and update them to meet our common challenges related to pandemics in our modern era. And so a few key changes were made to these regulations in 2005. One is that it applies now to any novel specimen coming out into a population. So it's no longer those four specific diseases. And anything can be reported to WHO, any novel outbreak. Another thing that changed was the whole kind of idea that countries were to stop the disease at the point of entrance and really refocus that we needed to stop diseases at the point of their source. And so we needed to have really good notification from countries. And there was a rule passed within the regulations that a country needed to report to WHO within 3 days the identification of a new novel pathogen that was spreading in their population. And so there was a whole codification of what kind of capacity and surveillance needed to be done at the national level in order to alert the global community about these outbreaks. And so there's a number of changes that occurred in 2005 and that we are now following under our current outbreak.
You mentioned SARS as being the motivation behind these new international health regulations, which gives us an opportunity to think about at least one specific parallel between the SARS outbreak in the mid-2000s and the current COVID-19 outbreak, and that's the country of China. I know part of the motivation behind strengthening the regulations and in general giving a bit more teeth to the World Health Organization was a global concern, if not outright anger, that the Chinese had not been fully forthcoming about the nature of the SARS outbreak, about when it happened. They kind of dragged their feet, you know, with informing other countries. Has COVID-19 shown the World Health Organization's ability to address at least the specific issue with China, shown that that's improved? So that, is it fair to say that global health specialists knew more about COVID-19 earlier than they did about SARS?
I definitely think that is true. And I think there's been a lot of effort on behalf of China to be transparent and to share information with the World Health Organization. And the World Health Organization has acknowledged that on multiple accounts. Their sovereignty is very important in our international system and government have control over their populations and over what happens in their country. And prior to 2003 and the SARS epidemic and the revision of the international health regulations, it really was in the control of individual countries to decide when and how they reported WHO. So it was much more normal for countries to wait for multiple weeks to months to report potential outbreaks to WHO at that time. Things have definitely sped up since then. So in 2009, really the first test of the new revised international health regulations with the outbreak of H1N1. In that outbreak, the average time between an identification of a case and reporting to WHO was 2.9 days. which falls within that three-day mandate of WHO. This was a reduction in weeks as compared to the average time of reporting during the SARS outbreak. So China wasn't the only country during the SARS outbreak that was slow to report. It was just the norm at the time and the procedures at the time that it took a lot longer to report. And so now we do see in this outbreak as well, countries reporting much more quickly to WHO, the identification of cases in their countries, and generally more transparency about the outbreak.
One of the main issues, particularly a few weeks ago, was WHO's initial reluctance to declare COVID-19 a pandemic. And then, of course, it will declare it a pandemic. But my first question is, what is your understanding about why WHO was initially reluctant to declare it a pandemic?
So it's important to remember that WHO, again, is a scientific technical agency that is basing their decisions on evidence. And it's very important to them that they be seen as a credible scientific organization because the recommendations and the guidelines that they put out are based on that reputation, right? That you trust us because we're not basing our decisions on politics, we're basing our decisions on the evidence that is being released and that we have and that we understand. So that can make them make decisions that are both perhaps a prior and like kind of faster than the politics, and at times slower than the politics, depending on the example. What they do, they have two mechanisms for kind of classifying these international disease outbreaks. One is what they did early on, which was this public health emergency of international concern designation, which is something that says the global community should really wake up and pay attention to this outbreak that we have and prepare and provide resources and be alert that this is a concern in our international community. And they did that pretty quickly. In terms of this outbreak, they released that within a couple weeks. They recognized it. They asked for resources. They asked for support for China and for low and middle income countries to prepare. That designation is separate from the pandemic designation. And so in that designation, they're following very strict guidelines related to community acquisition of the disease, right? So first they're seeing, is there community spread within a limited part of a country? Is it community spread nationwide? Is it community spread within multiple countries within a region? Is it community spread within multiple regions of the world? And then do we see community spread in all six WHO regions and in like kind of the majority of countries under the guidance of WHO? And so that's what they were kind of waiting for. They had recognized that there was community spread in China. They recognized that there was community spread regionally. They were kind of calling on countries to do everything they could to prevent the further community spread in countries before declaring it a pandemic. And so really by declaring a pandemic, what they're saying is that we now have community spread not being imported by travelers, but it's kind of independently spreading in all regions of the world within WHO's kind of mandate. So really when they make your decisions now, it is applied to all countries and not just those who previously were understood as experiencing the epidemics, but now it's clearly a global phenomenon.
Is the declaration of COVID-19 as a pandemic essentially a scientific decision, or are there policy recommendations, policy implications once the outbreak is declared a pandemic?
There are policy implications that can come from that declaration. And one of the things that happens when WHO declares a global pandemic is that individual countries then kind of automatically implement their national pandemic plans. And that can have widespread implications. So for example, it can have implications for vaccine availability. In the case of H1N1 in 2009, for example, when WHO declared a global pandemic in that case, the United States undertook its national pandemic response plan, which included the embargoing of all H1N1 available vaccine within the country. This had huge global implications because many countries, including Mexico, which in that case was the hardest hit country in that epidemic, had agreements with US-based pharmaceuticals for supply of the vaccine. And when this declaration was put in place and by WHO, and the United States implemented its national embargo as a response, that made it so that that vaccine was not available to communities abroad that needed it desperately, and perhaps more than the vast majority of Americans. So these declarations can have wide-ranging political and clinical implications.
With COVID-19, because there is no vaccine for it, what's the impact been on the flow of tests internationally to get to countries that particularly need them?
Well, we're really learning, and it's always a little bit to talk about these issues right when they're happening, because with the case of SARS or H1N1 or Zika or Ebola, we can talk about all of those with some great academic hindsight. Mm-hmm. When we're speaking about this at the moment, it's always a little tricky. But in the case of our current pandemic, it seems that a lot has been done by academic institutions, and a lot is being done through the network of the World Health Organization, so that tests are being prepared, it's being provided open access, it's being kind of delivered out, especially supporting low and middle income countries to get these resources. We know now, and we've experienced how the United States doesn't necessarily participate in those processes. So the United States likes to privatize these types of activities. So in the United States, we privatize our test market and we privatize our vaccines. We wait for individual companies to create them, and then they sell them, and we work through a market system to get availability. In this case, the market has been too slow. And we've seen that actually the open access and international community has been able to ramp up and generate and distribute the resources quicker than our private sector has been able to.
You're listening to Scholar Circle. ScholarCircle.org. We're discussing the COVID-19 pandemic, the role of the World Health Organization, and the international response with Professor Heather Whipfley of the University of Southern California. Let's start with China and South Korea. How effective have those nations' responses to COVID-19 generally been? Is it fair to say that those countries are developing a model that other countries should follow, or are there some pretty important lessons we should learn from mistakes that were made?
Well, that's a loaded question. And again, mm-hmm. It's a hard thing to discuss right at the moment.
Right.
Clearly, China has had success in kind of lowering the curve, as we're talking about here, and flattening the curve. And now, today, for the first time, declaring no new cases in the city of Wuhan, which is an incredible achievement for them. The costs and actions that they've taken to achieve that have been quite dramatic, and perhaps more dramatic than something that we could potentially implement in the United States. So they practiced extreme social distancing, which we're seeing in many cities now in the U.S. with home isolation, closing all public spaces and limiting personal interactions. But they really went beyond that in China, and they did widespread testing. They did door-to-door surveillance. They did track and trace very, very in depth. So they did both approaches. What we're seeing in South Korea is a really strong public health approach, like we would read about in a textbook of a perfect example of what you do in a public health situation. You go out and carry out extreme surveillance. So they're going and testing as many people as possible, identifying exactly where the disease is in their population, identifying exactly how it is spreading, and then cutting off those pathways of contagion. And they're doing that in a more kind of open way, in that they're not passing such strong draconian isolation measures. They're keeping society a little bit more open while they're carrying out a very strong public health response. They also have a nationalized health system, as does China. So it has a lot of capacity within the system to, you know, identify data, report on data, keep track of individuals. They know who everyone is. They have everyone's data in one place. So in both cases, you know, they're providing great examples of what can be done. The question is whether or not we both have the cultural, political, or medical capacity to replicate those examples, right? That's really the question. We have a completely different political system than China. We have a totally different healthcare system than both. We have totally different capacities in our ability to identify, reach, treat, test our population as does China or South Korea.
I think you're highlighting one of the more interesting questions about the use of tests and the way a lot of the discourse about tests in the United States are, in that the emphasis in the US seems to be, can we develop enough tests so that anybody who is considered an at-risk part of the population that might test positive for COVID-19 can get treatment, versus what you were describing for both of those countries, but in particular in South Korea, that the testing was more about getting data from the public in order to craft a more effective national response, rather than just a question about proper treatment for people who might test positive. Is that fair to say that's a fundamental difference between the two countries' approaches? Is the South Koreans were much more interested in getting population data, whereas the U.S. seems to treat this much more as individual treatments for people who might test positive?
That's true. So WHO's current recommendation to all countries is that they test every possible case. So anyone who comes in with any symptoms at all related, they should be tested. And every single case that is tested gives us an idea about the level of infection in the community. And so then we should test. And then if we have a positive, we should treat. We should also trace every individual who that person has been in contact with, isolate. And so it's isolation, test, treat, and trace. And that is what South Korea has done. It's not necessarily that they've tested everyone in the population, but they've tested everyone who felt they should be tested in terms of they had potential symptoms and they wanted to know. Here in the United States right now, we have very limited tests available, is my understanding, and also very strict guidelines from the CDC about who should be tested. And you're right. So you have to have very specific symptoms and be in a specific situation in order to be tested right now, in order to confirm your diagnosis and therefore the treatment you should receive. One of the things that the United States is recommending right now, for example, that's not in line with WHO recommendation, is that if you have symptoms, you should stay at home as long as possible and wait. Whereas in South Korea, if you were at home and you had symptoms, you should go to a drive-through testing center and get tested and recognize your status and have it be reported, so that, you know, we don't have a lot of people suffering and in houses and have no idea how widespread the disease is in our communities.
Do you think that's a cultural difference, or do you think that's a health care policy sort of delivery difference? Obviously, South Korea having a national health care system and the U.S. largely a private healthcare system, or is it in general sort of the way the U.S. treats healthcare issues versus the way, say, an East Asian country like South Korea treats it?
I think it's both, right? It's definitely both. So we have such a mosaic of organizations and different care systems within our system. So it's very hard to think of like one simple way of reaching everyone with a test, or a system in which we could reach everyone with the test, because that's not how our health system works. We're in so many different units and delivery systems. And so that's one big difference versus South Korea, where everyone's in the same system and everyone has access to the same resources. So, and there's no doubt that our infrastructure, our healthcare infrastructure here in the United States is challenged even in a good flu season or a bad flu season, right? Our emergency rooms are overloaded. We are always kind of at our limit We don't have surge capacity within the country. We all recognize that. There's availability for specific segments of the population that have wealth, and then there's huge amounts of the population who have access to almost nothing. So if anything, it's definitely true that the pandemic is laying bare the weaknesses of the U.S. health system, which have been, you know, identified and have been kind of outlined by the public health community, by the healthcare community, and by politicians over the last couple decades. And now we're really seeing political inability.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the COVID-19 pandemic, the role of the World Health Organization, and the international response with Professor Heather Whipfley of the University of Southern California. I think it's fair to say that for better or for worse, a lot of the U.S.'s social response has been relatively decentralized. Governors of states seem to be taking action much more so than the federal government. At one level, this helps to build some flexibility with states, because certain states certainly have different types of outbreaks and more intense outbreaks than others. But it opens the U.S. up to a criticism that there is a lack of coordinated response across states. On which side of that do you tend to fall? Is this something that is the generally decentralized response to the United States something that shows the strength of the U.S. response, or is it generally more of a weakness?
I think the decentralized response reflects the political system that we have. Mm-hmm. And the fact is that emergency response is highly decentralized legally. The legal and regulatory framework through which we handle emergency response is highly decentralized, giving a lot of power to individual states. And that's been built into our system from the Constitution down. So that's something that we can't entirely get over. There's no doubt that our federal leadership has lacked some clarity and some prioritization, especially early on in terms of the epidemic. And there's been some clear complaints all the way down to the local level that there has not been a clear kind of messaging and command about like kind of when actions and decisions should be taken. But I don't know if I would see that the localization of the response being necessarily like a strength or a weakness as much as a reflection of our political system and the way the United States is a federal republic. And we do give power to our individual states, and then local authorities also have authority to take actions. And in the case of the outbreak, it seems that local authorities are taking much wider spread kind of enforcement actions prior to the level kind of above them. And there's cause for some confusion related to that.
Earlier you said that the international health regulations do carry with it the strength of international law. They're meant to be followed. There may be not a terribly strong enforcement mechanism, but the effectiveness of WHO in responding to the global pandemic will build at least a legitimacy for the organization, which will strengthen enforcement, or maybe we don't call it enforcement, but certainly the willingness of states and state leaders to follow WHO recommendations. Do you see this as an opportunity for WHO to take an even bigger leading role, or is there a real sort of political hazard here? Because since the pandemic is real and it certainly had a profound impact on nations, how much risk does WHO take in the simple fact that, I mean, we have a pandemic and it could certainly, because of the pandemic, could be seen as ineffective in its response?
Well, this is new to all of us, but pandemic response is not new to WHO, right? They respond to SARS, and then they responded to H1N1 and Zika, and they're dealing with MERS, and they deal with this quite often. And by and large, they usually get negative reviews about how they handled it. And I think my feeling is, from what I see and what I read, is that actually WHO is handling this outbreak as well as perhaps could be expected, and we're definitely in an uncharted waters at this point, but WHO has been doing an excellent job with their daily briefings. They've been doing an excellent job with their communications and their social media, and really taking a calm, cool approach and doing innovative things. Like this week, we launched the solidarity study to focus on what types of treatment protocols are working best, something that they haven't done before. So really trying to take the lead, not only in regards to policy, but in regards to clinical care procedures and research and development. And so I see at this point, WHO coming out of this potentially with more influence and more respect. You know, one of the things is that over the past 10 to 15 years, not only in health, but whether it's in the environment and other areas of international collaboration, there's been a general disinterest, a lack of political will between countries to agree to binding legal agreements between each other. And maybe this will be a wake-up call that in our era of globalization, if we're going to re-engage the way we did before this pandemic, that we really do need to have some international regulatory authority to ensure our collective security, some more willingness and engagement on the behalf of states to agree to such things and to fund such programs.
You mentioned funding. Are you familiar, are you aware of any private foundations? You'd mentioned the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, you know, playing a substantial role in some previous pandemics. Is funding generally becoming available? I know this is really early on, but is there any talk about just, you know, better funding to help poorer countries or, you know, countries lacking resources to be able to confront, whether it's COVID-19 or certainly using this as a model to confront pandemics going into the future?
Well, I do think there's been a number of donations given to WHO over the last couple of weeks to support their work in the area. Just last week, perhaps you saw that WHO launched its first direct giving campaign, a few million dollars at least, where individuals around the world are donating to support WHO's mandate, something that had never been done before. So that's also a very interesting new kind of approach. Although individual giving will never make up for the multiple millions that individual governments can give and can contribute to WHO and to just general global health security and capacity. So we definitely will need that investment. And it seems that now WHO has been able to secure resources to at least support countries in getting their testing facilities up and running and helping low-income countries in particular be able to carry out the surveillance needed to hopefully contain the outbreaks in their countries.
If somebody wants to donate to WHO, do you go directly to the WHO website?
They do have a link on the WHO's website for their direct giving campaign.
Generally speaking, have you seen a pretty positive working relationship between WHO and the United States, whether it's the Center for Disease Control or some of the different agencies, some of which, it has been noted, aren't terribly well-funded or well-staffed right now? But I guess, first off, is the CDC basically taking the lead? And how well has CDC been working with WHO in this pandemic?
So outside of this pandemic, WHO has somewhat of, or the United States has somewhat of a love-hate relationship with WHO. The United States is not a strong multilateral leader within the United Nations system. We like to do things alone, and we don't necessarily support broad international, you know, kind of agreements and governance systems. So, but on the other hand, the CDC is an incredible resource to WHO, and it always has been providing technical expertise and assistance to the organization and to low and middle income countries in partnership with WHO. So on the technical side, the United States has been, and I'm sure continues to be, a very strong partner to WHO. But on the political side, on the funding side, on the support of its kind of regulatory mandate, not a strong partner. And we saw that with the testing debacle when WHO was able to help develop and then offer a test, and the United States declined, because it's the United States' understanding by and large that WHO is a is a resource for low and middle income countries. But the United States is technically so advanced or so capable that they don't need really the assistance of WHO. They're beyond that. And this has been a real wake up call to the United States in that type of arrogance that they can't just be above and separate to WHO. They're a member of the international community, and that means collaborating on all aspects of the work. And so we really got that one wrong, it seems, and hopefully moving forward with, a little bit more, a little less arrogance and collaboration on all types of issues. I saw that the United States, for example, is not part of the solidarity study. That's unfortunate. It would be beneficial if the United States was engaged in all aspects collaboratively in the work that WHO is trying to accomplish.
Absolutely. There's nothing else we learn from this. We must improve our response to global pandemic, and we must take global health policy even more seriously as we go into the future. Thank you very much, Professor Wickley, for all of your observations and your insights. Best of luck as you and I and everyone we know move our teaching to different platforms and with all the challenges of social distancing. And thank you for your time and be well.
Thank you.
You've listened to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, where we discussed the World Health Organization's role in the COVID-19 global pandemic, lessons that we can learn from the WHO's role, the effectiveness of the response, and other related issues. Our guest today was Professor Heather Wickley, who is the Associate Professor of Clinical Preventive Medicine and International Relations at the University of Southern California. And she's written The Global War on Tobacco, examining how the WHO negotiates and binds regulations on countries.
When we come back, Power in America, what it is, who has it, and how it works. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. It's no secret that top executives and corporate owners use their influence to maintain power through lobbying, think tanks, access to the media, campaign contributions. The people at the tops of the corporations and related institutions work to shape opinions and influence the laws and public policies. But can this dynamic be demystified and analyzed and properly understood? Our next guest does that. In a series of books, Professor William Domhoff has analyzed power in America, what it is, who has it, and how it works. Some of his books include the classic Who Rules America?, Who Really Rules?, Changing the Powers That Be, Diversity in the Power Elite, and Blacks in the White Elite. Welcome, Dr. Domhoff.
Thank you.
It's great to have you with us finally.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
So let's start with power itself. You talk about power as a dimension within the human experience that shapes our interactions and our institutions. Talk a bit about that.
I put it in the context that there's many other things. There's love and curiosity and joy and everyday life. But shaping everything is this one dimension of power that is in every part of life, whether it's in a family or an organization or in the larger society. And I think truly that the closest thing is to what we call a pecking order. There's a structure on who's on top, who's next level. And people fight to hold on to their level, even if it's a very middle kind of level. And the middle levels don't necessarily join together with the lower levels to try to change the higher level. So we've got this very much of a hierarchical society, and I think that's more or less true of most societies beyond a very basic level.
Now, you actually put it on a spectrum of egalitarian and domination. And so you say there's egalitarianism on one side and there's domination on the other.
And I think that if we look in the context of the United States, the people that want more equality on all kinds of things, whether it's the gender hierarchy or the color hierarchy or the sexual orientation hierarchy, they've ended up in this party called the Democratic Party, which is a very heterogeneous party, as you know. It's a gigantic collection of outgroups in America, whether on income or color or gender or a whole lot of things. And we have another party that's very hierarchical. People have their proper place. They should stay in it. That party has become even more concentrated on that issue. They resented the civil rights movement, and that moved a lot of whites, particularly in the South, into the Republican Party. They resented the feminist movement, and that moved a lot of people in there. They resented any people that didn't want to have a hierarchical religion or any religion at all. So that party is very hierarchical.
Now, the Democrats, some would hold, are still kind of buying into the hierarchy, and this is why there have been a lot of breakaways and trying to build third parties and sort of a thing. But you think that actually divides power too much?
Right. I think third parties are a dramatic mistake in the United States. They are the number one reason why the country is not more egalitarian. And the number one example of that is so obvious, and that's Ralph Nader in 2000. And many of us really begged him and others not to do that. And all that a handful of leftists and environmentalists had left on the day of the election was their vote. They had that power. They could do what they wanted. And in New Hampshire, enough of them, and in Florida, gave their vote to George Bush. And they always speak about how terrible and boring and so on Gore was and not very strong. And there were a million reasons why Gore failed in 2000. When it's that close, there's a million reasons. But there was one reason they controlled, and that was their vote. And that mentality, which involves some of the greatest minds in America, starting with Noam Chomsky and Barbara Ehrenreich and a lot of our most honored names, right there they were, by the hundreds, urging people to vote for Ralph Nader. And, of course, that was the start of our most recent disasters. That is what gave us George Bush, and they hate that, and they don't like me for saying it.
Yeah.
But that's the start of it. Anybody that's a feminist, an environmentalist, a gay rights activist, for them, putting Republicans in charge for 8 years has not made it pleasant or easier, not in the short run in their everyday lives, nor in the long run.
There's actually some conflicting research on this in the political science community as well.
There may be, but you're asking my opinion.
I am.
Telling you.
I know, but
that's a disaster.
I just didn't want to lose too much time.
Well, you'll lose your listeners. That's for sure.
Well, and I do know there's some conflicting research on how much of a role Ralph Nader actually played in the loss of the election. Because there's some research that those voters that voted for him actually weren't going to come out to vote anyway. But there's so many more things that I think that you bring to the table that I'd like to actually discuss, particularly with the structures of power in America and how these things kind of continue to reinforce themselves. You've talked about this in terms of class and in terms of money, but also in terms of the institutions they've created. The foundations, the think tanks. I want you to give us a kind of a thumbnail sketch.
Well, the basic point is that gradually over the 19th century developed this form of private property called a corporation, which can perpetuate itself, which has the same right as individuals. And from there, the campaign finance donations, the ability to hire lobbyists, the ability to hire front groups to go out and say they are Zionists and there's no global warming, all of those kinds of things in a gradual kind of accumulation now lead to a situation where the very important point is that they can capture control of government. And it's not just in the air or ideological. It is by having your people actually in the positions of importance in government, whether it's on coal mine safety or air quality or any of the issues of how the economy is formulated. We've seen this disaster over the housing crisis. The whole way it's attempted to be solved is, number one, to save the major investment banks. That's not because of some general ideology or belief system. It's because the people in corporations, through campaign finance and lobbying and hiring experts, have been able to structure the laws. So it's very specific. It's very direct. It's not behind the scenes. You can read about it every day in the New York Times. And the key things that they've been able to defeat were first the unions, and the defeat of unions went on gradually over the 60s and the 70s. And once they are defeated, because they were the number one bulwark against the corporations, cautious though they are, often corrupt, all of that, they were still the main power base for anybody that was not at the higher levels of the corporate community. And once that base was routed, then you're all set, because you're able to draw middle American whites into the Republican Party, voting their skin color, their religion, not their economics, and that social conservative coalition in conjunction with the corporate coalition leads to a situation where it's an easy rule. Corporations would be ruling as exactly they were throughout the early part of the 21st century, except for one thing, and that was the failure of the war in Iraq. There was nobody in America that could stop the George Bush coalition. The only thing that stopped it was that coalition themselves, because the war was a disaster, and in the 2006 election, the centrist turned against them. And if the Democrats happen to win, it will be because, once again, the centrists have felt that the economy has been run into the ground, and they will become fearful. And centrist women will become fearful that perhaps they will lose any right to choose. And those will be what decides the election, not whether the Democrats are clever or hide the fact that they want to tax the middle class. It's whether the centrist voters in America continue to decide to vote their various kinds of social issues versus their economic issues. The corporations have to have a set of loyal voters, and they've worked very hard at that, and they've found those voters through all of these what are called the social issues, and it really is very straightforward. Also, of course, you do work to keep as many people that might vote Democrat from voting, and there's a whole literature on voter suppression, about which there is little doubt by political scientists that Republicans do actively work to suppress turnout by low-income people who are slightly more likely to vote Democratic, although they certainly have their own prejudice around gender and color and so on. So that, in a nutshell, is what goes on in the United States. And the question before the America now is, are you going to vote your class and your economic interests, or are you going to vote your skin color and your ethnic prejudices and your religious preferences? That's what they face, and for the corporations, it will mean some accommodation, some small accommodations. If a centrist Democrat wins, they will have to pay a little more taxes, and so on and so forth. But it won't be a disaster to the corporate rich if they have to become part of a new coalition.
So, in fact, some political scientists have said that the president can't make any kind of radical change, that if he did try to make radical change, that there would, in fact, be kind of a corporate strike, which would be just this huge loss in confidence on Wall Street, and the economy would just go into the dump again.
I don't think any of that's true. If, for instance, a fairly liberal president was in charge, and you've got to have 60 votes in the Senate and a majority, of course, in the House, but in that situation, if corporations decided not to invest, which, of course, they would never stop investing, it's a crazy thought that came from crazy economists that they would stop investing somehow to get rid of the government. If they stop investing, other corporations will get their market share. Furthermore, the government would start making investments, as they did during the New Deal, as they did during World War II. And suddenly, the corporations who were allegedly on a capital strike would find themselves falling behind. So that's not going to happen. That's just, I think, in the fantasy realm of the kind of people that we didn't want to talk about earlier. So that's just not the real problem. The president has a really dramatic impact. If there's a centrist Democrat in the White House, then there's a whole lot of things that don't happen. Just the small changes in taxes, and I'm no fan of Bill Clinton's, I can assure you, but just the small changes that he made in the taxes, which had no impact on the lifestyle of the very rich, they made a huge difference in the American economy. So, yes, you're not allowed to talk about taxes. The Republicans yell and scream about taxes, and George Lakoff wants to properly frame all that. But the truth of the matter is that if there were a progressive taxation in this country, taxes on the well-to-do, just to the level there was when Ronald Reagan came in, of course you could pay for all of these programs. Of course you wouldn't have these huge debts. The debt disappeared under Clinton. The Republicans were so shocked, they were afraid. What is this? We don't have a debt. So you can make a huge difference who you put in charge of the Federal Reserve, who's in charge of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Now, you're never going to get suddenly some paradise. You get a benign society like a Canada. God forbid, we might even decent as Germany or Denmark or so on. And very easily done in terms of instead of the top 10% having 70-some percent of the wealth, the top 10% only has 50% of the wealth. And that, those other countries, makes a huge difference. So I think it matters who's the president. I think there's all sorts of things you can do to the economy. There are ways to tame the giant corporations. All of that is right there. It's easily enough done. But analysis by the insurgents, by the opponents, has not been good. The liberals and the leftists have never been able to develop a sensible coalition in America. And the net result is, and I like George Lakoff, know him, think he's great, but the net result, because of the fact that liberals and leftists can't make a strategic alliance, is that we have to worry about framing instead of about fighting it straight out on the bigger kind of issue. Yeah, we've got to unionize. Yeah, we've got to do this and that and the other thing that are, as I say, all doable.
William Domhoff, thank you so much for joining us. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.